You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Incoming U.S. President Barack Obama will have a number of foreign policy challenges when he takes office. The U.S. war in Iraq, another in Afghanistan, the Israeli war in Gaza, and a general deterioration of the position of the U.S. worldwide. All this has been framed as the failed legacy of the Bush regime, and Obama has been promising change. So what do his appointments to key positions in his foreign policy team indicate? Stephen Zunis is a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. He's joined me by phone to discuss Obama's new appointments. Good morning, Stephen, and welcome to Red Eye.
Good morning.
Perhaps the key position in any foreign policy team is Secretary of State, and Obama has chosen Hillary Clinton for that post. What could we expect from her?
This is a profoundly disappointing experiment for those of us who were hoping for a more enlightened foreign policy. He had excited quite a few Americans with his statement that he didn't just want to end the war in Iraq. He wanted to end the mentality that led to the war in Iraq, the mindset that led to the war in Iraq. And Hillary Clinton is very much an illustration of this, that she had a long-standing record, not only of supporting U.S. military intervention, but arguing that essentially the United States is above the law in terms of the United Nations Charter, in terms of its interpretations of international humanitarian law, and a whole series of other policy positions ranging from the Balkans to Israel-Palestine to Iraq, Iran, that in many ways is closer to that of the Bush administration than the vast majority of the people who elected Barack Obama to office. In addition, she has been one more critical analysis. I mean, she blindly accepted the claim that Iraq had somehow miraculously rebuilt its chemical and biological weapons arsenal, that they had somehow rebuilt a nuclear program, even though the International Atomic Energy Agency, you know, was indicating otherwise, even though she was being advised by a whole number of people that the so-called intelligence being put forward by the Bush administration was not to be taken seriously. And so putting all these together, we find someone who really represents some of the worst of U.S. foreign policy in recent years.
She did change her attitude a little, very, very late. Was that simply opportune?
Yeah, she did eventually call for a withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq. This is something that she had rejected up until the time she announced her decision to run for president, and she saw the polling data, which was very clear that there was no way she would have any chance of securing the nomination if she continued to support the war. It seems like it was a very opportunistic kind of a position. But at the same time, some people argue, well, maybe she is a political chameleon, or maybe maybe as Secretary of State, she'll recognize that she has to do what the president says, and maybe because she represents more the right wing of the party, that she can help him get away with things he might not otherwise do. So the appointment of Clinton should not necessarily mean that his foreign policy will be less progressive than he implied during the campaign. But nevertheless, it was a surprise and then disappointment to many people in the rank and file of the party who support him and defeating Hillary Clinton in the primaries, in large part because of their differences on foreign policy.
Well, that's one appointment, and as you say, you could regard with some ambiguity the possibilities of a different policy than Clinton's espousing. But what does it mean when we look at his choice of Robert Gates, the Bush Secretary of Defense? Some, like myself, would call it Secretary of War. He was retained. What sort of policies is he an advocate of?
Well, he was, in many ways, he was seen as one of the somewhat more pragmatic people within the Republican Party establishment. He was on the Iraq Study Group, which called for, you know, moderating Bush's failed policies in that country somewhat. But he, if you look at his history, going back to the Reagan and Senior Bush administrations, he was one of those who would put forward some of these really alarmist and phony reports about the Soviet military power in the 1980s. Here the country was on the verge of collapse, and Gates is one of those pushing the idea they were getting ahead of the United States and, you know, could, you know, take over and that kind of nonsense. He also was had some, you know, dealings with some of the horrific human rights abuses by American client states in Central America and with the Contras and the like, and he's a pretty shady character in a lot of ways. I think the Obama people try to rationalize for it by saying, hey, we're in the middle of two wars. It's good to have this kind of continuity. He is a more pragmatic a figure, but hardly. Hardly an ancient agent of change, and hardly one to question the whole idea is, why is it that the United States, years after the end of the Cold War, has a higher military, has its highest military budget ever? Why are we increasing our military spending and increasing the number of men under arms when the United States already spends over half of the entire military spending in the entire world combined?
Now, Obama, beyond Gates, has chosen as his national security advisor a retired Marine General, James L. Jones. What political perspective does he represent?
Well, he's another Republican. And someone who has played a major role in NATO. He also takes a pretty hard line in terms of how he sees the United States in the role in terms of power projection, the use of force. He is there are some indications that he had some serious questions about the decision to invade Iraq. He also, more than a lot of people in the military, has a good working relationship then with European countries. He speaks several languages and the like. He's something of an intellectual, which is less and less common nowadays among career military men. But again, he's very much into the very, you know, traditional paradigm. I mean, when you think of Gates and Jones, I mean, they would have been likely picks of John McCain had he been elected.
The last appointee I want to ask you about is less concerned directly with foreign policy, but he's been named to the key post of Chief of Staff. That's Rahm Emanuel. What kind of input do you think he will have on foreign affairs for the Obama government?
Well, in some administrations, the chief of staff can be just about the most important pick, but that's primarily for presidents who don't quite have the intellectual capabilities of Obama. So hopefully he will not be as powerful as some chiefs of staff. There's concern because he is also definitely from the right wing of the Democratic Party. He was the only Democrat in the entire Illinois congressional delegation to support the invasion of Iraq. He's been under President Clinton when he was on his staff. He was a big mover in pushing through NAFTA and the destruction of much of the U.S. welfare system. So on economic issues, he's pretty conservative. And, he's been a big hawk on Iran, a big hawk on Israel, big hawk on a whole number of foreign policy issues. What the chief of staff does, on the one hand, you know, people say, well, you know, this is more of an administrative kind of position, not a policy position, and this is a guy who can get things done. He's a political operative, more than a policy type person. But the problem is that the chief of staff is kind of the gatekeeper for the president. To Obama's credit, he's been the kind of person who's willing to listen to people from a variety of perspectives. He's not like Bush, where he just gets a bunch of yes men around him to tell him what he wants to know. Obama actually is willing to, you know, listen to a variety of perspectives, including people from the left. But with Emanuel as the gatekeeper, it raises the concerns that he will not get the variety of perspectives that particularly from the progressive end of the political spectrum in key foreign policy decisions.
Last night, I was listening to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and they were interviewing an Israeli officer in the Air Force who had some years ago refused to any longer fly and bomb Palestinians. And he said he was asked about his attitude, whether he hoped for better from Obama. And he said, I will tell you a story I had years ago when I quit the Israeli Air Force. I went to Chicago and I met with Obama and his staff. This was before he was considering, at least publicly, to run for president. And I told them my attitude and my criticism of the Israeli government. And they said to me, we agree, we agree, we agree. And he said, that before he left, they said, thanks for all this input, and we now have to take this to AIPAC, the Israeli lobby, and see what they think of that.
Yeah, it's you hear these stories, and I've been told these stories as well. And you know, there's no question that AIPAC and related groups do have a fair amount of clout, especially on Congress and the legislative branch. But frankly, I think that kind of a story we hear is exaggerated quite deliberately to get politicians off the hook. I mean, it's very convenient to say, oh, we agree with you, we'd like to help, but, you know, there's rich and powerful cabal of Jews behind the scenes are the ones who really control things, so don't blame us if we vote the wrong way. I mean, to me, that's borderline anti-Semitism, because, you know, it's the old thing about, you know, it's the Jews' fault, not ours, you know, we're blameless, you know, whatever. And, I mean, I have seen, when I look at the data, I mean, I look at the people who, this horrible resolution back in 2006, passed by Congress overwhelmingly, bipartisanly, supporting Israel's war on Lebanon. Every single member of Congress who refused to support that legislation ended up getting reelected by an even bigger margin than they had 2 years earlier. And we also, and most of the stories of people who have been, you know, defeated because they opposed AIPAC, there were all sorts of other groups that were trying to defeat them that year, and all sorts of other special interests. That, you know, I think in many ways that they're a non-factor, but I think really if you look at U.S. policy on Israel, and it's all too typical of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East as a whole, in fact for that matter, and Latin America, Southeast Asia, Southern Africa, and everywhere else. I mean, we didn't need a pro-Indonesia lobby to support Suharto and his occupation and oppression and colonization of East Timor. We don't really have a Moroccan-American lobby that somehow forces our government to support Morocco's invasion, occupation, colonization, repression in Western Sahara. Unfortunately, the U.S. government is quite capable of supporting allies engage in violations of the U.N. Charter and international law and to occupy weaker nations without some domestic ethnic group somehow forcing our hand to do so. Mm-hmm. So I think that certainly AIPAC has had a lot of groups have had a role in limiting debate somewhat, and they have made things more difficult for those of us who take a more pro-peace, more pro-human rights perspective on the conflict. I really think their role in terms of causing our policy is exaggerated. I think our policy would be more or less the same even if AIPAC did not exist. There'd be a little more debate, there'd be a little more challenge to it, but I think that by and large the policy would not be all that different.
So the responsibility lies with Barack Obama directly, in your view?
Exactly, as well as the American people. Because if you look at almost all the foreign policy issues that people have struggled with in the United States, Vietnam, the nuclear arms race, South Africa, Central America, East Timor, Iraq, et cetera, rarely, if ever, with a few countries of exceptions, have democratic politicians led. Generally, they've been dragged kicking and screaming by the grassroots. I mean, the Democratic Party initially supported the Vietnam War, opposed sanctions in South Africa, opposed a nuclear freeze, supported intervention in Central America, supported support for Suharto and Indonesia, et cetera, et cetera. It was only after you got these mass movements that the Democrats would change their tune, like we were talking about a few months ago with Hillary Clinton. That a change in her part would not have been possible if people hadn't mobilized. And what gives me hope about Obama and his tenure, despite all these reservations about his cabinet, is that the rank and file of the Democratic Party is very different than it was, say, in 1993 when Bill Clinton was first coming to office. Polls show rank and file Democrats are well to the left of where they were 16 years ago. Polls, the fact is that the grassroots of the party is much more organized. Back then, one of the most significant internal party pressure groups was the Democratic Leadership Conference, which was a fairly conservative group that Rahm Emanuel was very active in. But now you have groups like the Progressive Democrats of America. I mean, we actually have a fairly strong a peace-oriented and social democratic-oriented wing of the party, which was really had not seen in many, many years. And so Obama owes his election to that wing of the party. And the question is, will the American people just sort of have a sigh of relief and celebrate that Bush is gone and trust Obama to do the right thing, or are we going to organize and put on the pressure to force him to make the changes that people are expecting? And the fact that Obama got his start as a community organizer, I think, says a lot about how he recognizes where change really comes from. It does come from the grassroots, and I think that really is a challenge before the American people right now.
Okay, thank you very much, Stephen.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. I've been speaking with Stephen Zunis. He's a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco, frequent contributor to Alternet. You can check his articles on Obama's foreign policy team and other topics at alternet.org.